Welcome to another episode of RVW Wealth Wisdom Podcast. On this week's episode, we'll be hosting Alex Brucker of Brucker and Mora. Alex has been a longtime thought partner of us and service provider to many clients who we share when it comes to complex pension planning and ERISA matters. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, so Alex, the first question we have for you is, what is ERISA? And what federal government departments have the responsibility and jurisdiction over ERISA matters?
Well, ERISA is a federal law that governs the operations, maintenance, and fiduciary conduct of all qualified, tax-qualified retirement plans and welfare benefit plans. The purpose of ERISA was essentially to make sure that employees who were being benefited by employers under these plans really received their benefits, and to be a watchguard over the conduct of those people who operated and maintained and ran the plans. They're called fiduciaries. The reason for ERISA was essentially that prior to ERISA, the only laws that impacted federal laws that impacted qualified plans was tax law, the Internal Revenue Code for tax advantages. But what happened with fiduciary conduct everywhere and the promises that were made, the tax code didn't do anything. You had to look to state law, and all the states had different laws. So the concept of ERISA was to make a uniform set of laws that apply to all states. And so therefore, ERISA has a very, very powerful preemption provision, which actually says that if you have a plan that has certain violations, you can't go under state law. You are preempted, and you have to go under federal law for enforcement.
Are all pension plans governed by ERISA?
No. Let me give you the basic difference here, because that goes into the issue of what ERISA is, which is let me explain it to you in the following way. The federal government has three essential departments or agencies that govern the jurisdiction and enforcement of ERISA. One is the Internal Revenue Service, which essentially governs tax compliance. I'll get into that more later. The Department of Labor, which really focuses itself on the conduct of those people who are running and operating the plans, the fiduciaries. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is an agency that deals with guaranteeing benefits to employees when a defined benefit pension plan terminates.
That's kind of the equivalent of like FDIC insurance,
but in the pension space. It's essentially the FDIC of the pension world.
Right. Okay.
That's what that does. Now, you just asked the question. Say it again, the question.
Are all plans governed by ERISA?
Yeah, okay. Remember, the ERISA is a labor law as well as a tax law. All plans are governed by the tax law. Most plans are governed by the labor law, ERISA. ERISA does not cover IRAs, individual retirement accounts, plans in which the sole owner is the sole employee and the sole participant. Now, a sole owner includes a wife. Their husband and wife are deemed to be one person. And then there's a special idiotic rule that says that ERISA will not cover a plan in which the only, which is a partnership or LLC, for example, in which the only participants are the partners themselves.
Got it. Okay. So really, ERISA sounds like it's looking out for the rank and file of a company.
Well, the purpose of it, because it's a fiduciary law, when you think about it, if I'm my own person and I violate the law, I'm not going to sue myself for fiduciary breach.
Right. Sure.
The IRS is going to come after me. But if I have an employee that I have to be – or somebody I have to be responsible to for my conduct, then that's where ERISA will come in.
So if you're a manager or owner of a company with 100 employees and you have a 401k in place, talk to us about that owner or manager's responsibility relative to those employees.
Okay. Let's just talk about the 401k area in general first, and then I'll get to the specifics.
Right.
My view, and it's really my view, and maybe others share it, 401k plans are a true, true, true employee benefit plan. Mm-hmm. It is not for owners and executives to think that they're going to retire on 401k. It's nice to put a couple hundred thousand dollars away over your lifetime, But you and I both know that within our communities, no one that's a little nest egg. It's not a retirement fund.
Okay? Based on the limitation of $18,500 or the
right.
bonus.
Yes, based on the limitations in of itself.
It's not enough being contributed for
so
owners.
From the tax standpoint, 401k, to me, and we can talk later about my work with the Small Business Council of America, I am proposing I will be proposing legislation to basically get rid of all the rules and regulations on tax issues regarding 401k plans, because I find it absolutely nonsense to have to do all this testing in 401k plans because an executive wants to put away $18,000 a year. It's absolutely absurd.
Just so listeners know, I mean, we may get into this later, but the issue here is that the Department of Labor wants to make sure that plans aren't favoring, what they consider highly compensated
employees.
That's
not the Department of Labor. That's the Internal Revenue Service.
Okay.
That's the tax law.
Okay.
All right. But the point of the man, my point is that, yeah, that's correct. That's always been the major tenet of the tax law. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that for a lousy $18,000 a year, they're costing employers a fortune on administration that's not necessary, and they cost the employees that as a result of it.
Okay.
It should be just done, frankly, very simply. Even if you have to put a mandate in that the employers have to put in 3% of contributions for every employee across the board, and then do whatever you want without any testing and without all this absurd regulation work.
You might come out ahead on the costs, kind of what you're thinking.
Well, I think it's also the administration. It's the paperwork that goes into it.
Right.
And the risk of noncompliance.
Well, and you have the risk of noncompliance from a federal standpoint.
Which is very costly.
Yeah, well, it is because – well, it's more that depends upon whether it's the Department of Labor or the Internal Revenue Service. The Department of Labor is going to look at something completely different. They're not going to look at these tax issues that we just talked about, mm-hmm. the amount of money goes in, the discrimination or anything like that. They're going to look at the conduct of the people who have control over the plan, which they refer to as fiduciaries, which is a very broad term, and look at that conduct of how they are acting with respect to their benefiting or costing the employees, the investment choices, any acts that would violate their fiduciary responsibility, which is very broad in nature. And there are a lot of people out there that are fiduciaries that they don't realize. So the employer that sets up a plan is a fiduciary. The trustee of the plan, if it's in trust, is a fiduciary. Essentially, in a small business, the shareholders are fiduciaries. The board of directors are fiduciaries. The officers can be fiduciaries because they have control over decision-making power, especially those who can write a check, deposit the money, have control over the money and any authority over the money and the investment aspects of it. The other people who get to be fiduciaries are service providers who have control over the money. So if all of a sudden I have and this happens quite often, is that if I have a administrator or a trustee that says, send me the check and I'll get it deposited into the plan, that person now has control over the money. Because you have no control. Once you give up control, it's not in the trust. Somebody else has the plan. If they have decisions over making who gets what and how, who gets what and cuts the check, that is a fiduciary. So service providers can fall into that trap. Broker dealers can fall into that trap. And there are cases out there now where the Department of Labor is looking at the broker dealer aspects of what they're doing from an investment standpoint, and coming after them and calling them fiduciaries where they never thought they were. And we all know that the Department of Labor issued regulations to say that almost anybody in the brokerage industry selling a brokerage account or an investment is a fiduciary and has to act in the best interest of their clients, so to speak. Those regulations have basically been suspended. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be enforced under this administration. As to whether they come back again is another thing. And as to whether the Department of Labor just goes ahead and tries to offer that in court. Because when you think of it, when you're handling investments over a retirement plan, especially when there are employees there, okay, and you have some sort of control, you are acting in a fiduciary capacity. And your job is to be in the best interest of your client. not for yourself. And you can see where the conflicts can come in when you're dealing with certain brokerage firms. I mean, you probably have seen it in your own experiences with people.
I feel like one of the things that makes the whole concept of fiduciary kind of confusing in this space is, I think as a culture and a society, we're more in the habit of thinking about, you know, like the fiduciaries and, you know, singular as opposed to plural, and thinking of it as sort of who's the designated, the buck stops here person. But it seems like the way fiduciary, the role of a fiduciary is sort of seen by the Department of Labor is it's almost more a label for where does the responsibility spill out? You know, who can we go after?
It's essentially defined as anybody that has investment control and authority over the management and administration of the plan and its assets, and anybody who gives investment advice for a fee. Yeah.
And then it's very sort of specific in terms of where and how you can actually kind of offload any fiduciary, you know, like.
Well, but the answer is you can delegate. Yeah. This is a very good question. The ultimate person responsible is the employer, mm-hmm. because the employer is the one who sets up the plan and administers the plan as a general rule and selects and delegates the duties to other people. Mm-hmm. So the employer has the ultimate responsibility. And when they delegate those duties around, they're still required to do due diligence with who they delegated to, and they're required to monitor. So if I give discretion to this individual to do investments at that person's discretion and give them the money to make that discretion, that person becomes a fiduciary. Mm-hmm. But if I don't I have a duty still to do due diligence as to who I appoint and monitor what that person is doing. The Department of Labor will always come back to me.
Okay. So if you're an owner of a company and you have investment advisors in the plan, involved in the plan design and administration, you can assign that advisory firm various levels of fiduciary duty, not to absolve yourself of such duties, but to delegate the duty. So you share the burden, if you will.
Right. Yeah.
Talk to us about the two common duty standards out there and the distinction between them, because I think a lot of our clients have set up plans. They had one great meeting with an advisor who told them how to run it, and that's it. No one's heard from the advisor since. Employees haven't heard from the advisor since. And I want to hear from you, Alex. What should our listeners who tend to be business owners be doing on a regular basis and understanding the role and the define both roles?
Yeah. The primary fiduciary duties, you have an extraordinary different type, stronger standard of care. You have to have a standard of care and act prudently based on the fact that you are holding benefits for employees and providing and promising those benefits to the employees. All right. It's not different than any other beneficiary. It's based on trust law. So you look at trust state tax law, which you know is very strong and involved in any state level.
It's a system that's been around for over 100 years.
Oh, no, not just 100 years, thousands of years.
Okay.
I mean, it goes all the way back in trust law. But the point of the matter is that when you look at ERISA has a much more broader and stronger standard. So they have a duty to diversify their investments. They can't put all the eggs in one basket. They have a duty to follow the plan documents. So they have to understand and read the plan documents. And they have a duty to make sure that the costs are reasonable, that the charges are not overly charged to the employees. And that's where the real issue of 401k is. Because when you think about it this way, think about the market of 401k. The market 401k is sold as a bank account or a brokerage account. You know, it's sort of, don't worry, be happy. The money's going in there. We're going to take care of it and everything else. Like that. The genius of 401k, when you think about it, is that the employee is paying the cost of it. It's coming out of employee's pocket. All the expense sharing ratios, commissions, and everything else are coming out of his pocket. The employer's cost is just, you know, administration. Maybe has person at the maybe they have a person at the company that they have to pay for to watch over everything who doesn't really understand what's going on. But the point of the matter is that the employees are the ones who are being charged. Think about it this way.
Alex, just on that point, you can allocate costs to the company if you choose to.
Okay. The answer
is, if you're a very generous employer, you can say, we'll bear the costs.
That's fine. Find me one. Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be.
That's
overly...
okay. But I'm going to brag about our own employment practices here for a moment.
Okay, that's okay.
And if you keep the costs low enough,
then you're doing something that most employers do not do because
correct.
If, for example, you're looking at a 401k plan and they are with investment provider A and they're charging so many basis points for their fees. Let's assume 100 plus basis points, and all of a sudden you say, we should only be paying X basis points, okay? But if you look at the basis points that are paying, if the employer paid that cost, which is high, there would be no 401k. So the employees, regardless of how generous the employer is, and it's amazing that employers are generous like you are, but it's amazing that they are, but that is still a cost to them. And the employer's job is to make sure that the cost they are getting is what is standard in the industry, whatever that standard is. And we know that as a result of competition and regulation in this industry, the costs have come down dramatically as to what they used to be. But everybody is playing this game of costs.
But going back to what the employee can sort of delegate, that there's really two standards that I'm aware of, and I want to discuss that with you. The one standard is the duty to set up the plan the first time and make sure that the structure and fees are correct or fair or reasonable. And then there's the ongoing plan – the ongoing standard.
Yes, right. Are you thinking of the sort of Section 338A fiduciary? Well, yeah, versus here's what it is.
That's exactly right. I didn't want to get too technical with
I don't like talking code sections.
See, often we've been engaged by plans to actually on a going forward basis to in real time regulate and monitor not only the structure,
that
but the performance
the key,
and
that
the costs.
That is the key to it. So now you just hit upon the most important aspect of a fiduciary's conduct.
This is what I want to get to. This is what our listeners want to hear.
Okay, because this becomes really significantly important. And it goes to the issue of delegation of duties and how you, as an employer, insulate yourself. All right, so let's try to work that out by example. So interrupt me with any other thoughts that you might have.
And there's an issue here with process, right? Is that
this is a process, right?
In looking through the Department of Labor's literature, my understanding is that they're really trying to hold the employer to what they really care about is that the employer is following the process and documenting adhering to the plan document and sort of checking the boxes. Yep. But as long as that process is done properly and involves, you know, bringing in an investment advisor, then that does, this, you know, you'll describe
well,
this, but in
two,
a way allows
there are
them
two
to...
levels of investment advisor.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So let's talk about the 401k process. You're right. The setting up of the plan itself and the writing of the plan and the design of the plan is an employer function. It's not a fiduciary function. The fiduciary function is the investment choices, who's delegated to that, and all that process, okay? That's just right there. So in other words, when my nephew comes to me who's a broker and say, I want to set up a 401k plan for you, and because it's my nephew, I'm going to send it to him. I haven't done any due diligence. All right? Mm-hmm. I don't know what the hell's happening. It's a bank account. What do I care? Okay? That's the real problem in the 401k area. So due diligence from an employer standpoint means that you should be investigating several different options that are available to you. You should get advice from, you know, input from different people because you have to vet it because you just can't go to person A because they're relative or something like that. That's going to create a problem. We all know that. Mm-hmm.
Also document this as they're doing it.
Okay, yeah. Well, the document never gets reviewed. The document's going to be just spit out as if it was a boilerplate document. But you have to look at the investment contracts and the service contracts too. So let's go back to what you really said about, and that's the monitoring issue. So if I go to an investment provider and I set up the 401k plan and they come out to me and they say, well, these are your choices for investments and we recommend A, B, C, and D or suggest A, B, C, and D, and you do that, okay, now you've got to that point. The question is, how do you deal with the monitoring of all that? You've got one person who's taking and running those funds or basically being the investment provider. But who is investigating and monitoring the investment provider? Okay. So essentially, if you really, and this is where this cost comes in, and that's what bothers me about the whole area is that in order to really insulate yourself, you have the investment provider, whoever that is.
And then, in this case, we'd be talking about like a company that actually creates the funds.
That's
so
right.
A Schwab or
any one of the major brokerage institutions
or
the banking institutions.
Okay.
But then you should have somebody that insulates you that on a quarterly or semi-annually basis is monitoring the choices, putting them on lists as to whether or not they should be watch lists, mm-hmm. should be changed. Are they performing the way they're supposed to perform or anticipating to perform? Has the management changed? And therefore, you're looking at the performance. You have to have somebody who they're on some sort of a quarterly, depending upon the size, or at least semi-annually or annually monitoring everything to make sure that, number one, the fees that are being charged are reasonable and that the plan is performing as it should be under the market in a standard condition. And you've documented that, therefore the employer becomes insulated.
And this is the kind of thing that like an RIA or like what we do.
That's exactly right. Yeah. If you are a 338 or something like that, where you're in there and you're monitoring what's going on, you're monitoring the Schwab or the Fidelity or whoever it is, that is the way that you insulate the employer.
Mm-hmm. So let's just break this down for our listeners who may be plan sponsors. You set up a plan, you do diligence to the provider, and everything's great. That's only the first step.
You have a monitoring position every year.
I mean, on a regular basis, you need to be engaging with the plan, that means, to make sure that your participants have access.
You can't look at this as a brokerage account or a bank account and go to sleep.
Got it.
Okay.
I appreciate you articulating that so clearly.
I mean, that's where the real problem is.
Would negligence be how would negligence be seen? And what's the impact? Let's play that out. We got a doc client with 50 employees, and he uses a single what I'd call a packaged provider, one of the big insurance companies. He set it up 20 years ago, and that's it. What is his real downside? And how long does that statute go? Bottom line, what happens here? He's not looked at the fund lineup forever.
Let's be practicable.
Yeah, practical, exactly.
I mean, because you can get into legalistics that would drive any human being nuts over this thing. All right, but let's be practicable about this whole thing. One, no one is going to be complaining about anything if everybody's making money. That's reality. I mean, if the market goes up and the investments are performing and there isn't any kind of craziness that's happening to the value of the funds and they're acting fine, and no one's going to complain, not even the Department of Labor.
But everyone will look at relative performance. So in a year where things are rising by 15 or 20% and your employees' plans only rising by 6 or 7%, that's going to be a problem even though it's positive.
I'm not sure, again, because that depends upon – when you're dealing with 401k, everybody has their own investment choices, all right? So they're going to be investing conservatively or
– But in apples to apples, if you've got an aggressive portfolio design and the broad markets are doing 20% and you're doing 5%, it's going to be a problem.
I guess it's a question of degree. I mean, it may very well be a question of degree. The issues that happen with in the securities area – more than anything else, is the type of securities that are sold.
Okay.
Whether they're A shares, S shares, R shares, whatever they're called. But the type of securities that go. I have a case now that I'm involved with the Department of Labor, and we should get into the Department of Labor because they're the real issue here. And they're the real enforcement agency here. Their representatives and their brokers and the broker dealer has been selling A shares to all of its pension plans,
which again, those are high fee.
Those are front loaded. The SEC, FINRA, and the Department of Labor are very concerned about that, and so they're attacking this broker dealer for offering A shares, and basically gave them a cease and desist order, not to sell A shares anymore, and they're going to possibly go after them for fiduciary liability for the excess commissions that are received. But they have to be able to prove that what they received was unreasonable. And I'm not sure what's reasonable or unreasonable in the securities. You have to look at the standard of in the industry. So if the standard in the industry getting is a 5% or give or take commission on everything that's done, and all of a sudden you're taking 10%, you can understand that.
But in that case, the plan sponsor had an opportunity to give an equivalent investment exposure with a fraction of the fees. Surely that would be a blatant violation of their duty.
The answer is you're right. But remember, but again, when you're dealing with that, there's no monitoring. You're doing this and you're accepting everything that's going on without even looking at it, because I, frankly, as experienced in this area over 40 years, it's very seldom that I see an employer looking at the bank brokerage statements, looking at the account statements, and looking at what's going on with the account from a daily basis, buying and selling and things like that that can go on. You just don't know, because it's all buried in a— you get a statement that's 60 pages long every month as to what's going on in a plan. It's to the normal person like myself, it's incomprehensible. It's like reading an actuarial statement.
So the case you were just describing, though, it sounds like the Department of Labor went after the broker-dealer
as a
breach of fiduciary. But they're not really going after the—
well, the answer to that, that's a really interesting thing. They're going after the broker-dealer, but ultimately— – the employer has the responsibility to monitor. Mm-hmm. So there is some responsibility still to let, as to whether or not they share, whether they take on the employer. If they can get all the money from the broker dealer, that's one thing. But if they want to go further, they can take on the employer for the employer not looking at. The employer is getting all the— – if you get— – the employer is getting brokerage statements and doesn't look at it and doesn't understand them, and all of a sudden he's seeing churning or this or that.
Does that open the employer up to lawsuits— yes. from the participants?
Yes.
Does that make their case stronger if the Department of Labor has— – okay.
The answer is, remember, the Department of Labor there is there to protect the participants. Their actions are in order to protect the plan and the participants. Participants have that right also under the law. But the participants, if they come in and want to make claims against me, they're going to file claims against everybody, including the employer, because everybody's collectively in that.
What's the statute?
Statute of limitations for a fiduciary breach under ERISA is 3 years from knowledge, 6 years when there's no knowledge, and unlimited if it's fraud and concealment.
So for—
– as a general principle.
General principle. So let's assume 6 years is really the tail on these issues. And from what I'm hearing from you, it's not as much performance as it is fees. And fees are something you could objectively measure and monitor with ease as an employer.
That's right.
And therefore, you're going to be held to a higher standard. Whereas performance, there's a good argument. You can always make a good argument that your portfolio was positioned in a different way. Or
let me give you the example of all examples, 2008, 2009.
Kibble.
Okay. But the market crashed. Okay. You didn't see one lawsuit from a fiduciary breach as a result of the market crashing. All right? The only lawsuits that came in, when you talk about the Tibble case and all the other cases, are based on the fees that were charged and the shares that were sold.
Got it.
All right.
So that point is valid. So
therefore, from a standpoint, it's hard. I joke around about it as I speak all over the country on this. And I basically say, you know a fiduciary breach when you see one. So if I invested in Syrian war bonds, for example, all right, mm-hmm. you know that that's a per se fiduciary breach. The money's just going to go out and get lost. So you have to really look at the investments and look at and that gets into another point. And I'm going to go a little bit off track, if you don't mind, for a second, because this is really, really important from the investment standpoint. My firm belief is that once the employer or a client thinks that they're smarter than anybody else, which generally they do, and they think that then they get scared because of the volatility of the marketplace. And we know that we have a volatile marketplace. We're lucky we're in a bull market for the last 10 years. We know there's going to be an issue, and that we know darn well if something happens, you just don't panic. All right? Because the market comes back. That's America. That's how we live here. Point of the matter is, a lot of these people say, all right, I can't take this volatility. I want to go outside the marketplace, the public marketplace, and start invest in private investments, into real estate, into LLCs, into limited partnerships, into loans, and so on and so forth. That's where the fiduciary hits even more so, because How many people are that smart to be able to do that and how do the due diligence for it to get it straight? And that's where the Department of Labor really can come in at you from a due diligence standpoint and a fiduciary standpoint. They're much more, especially when you have employees that are at stake.
Right.
All right. And that really becomes the key to it. Also, there are so many traps for the unwary when you go outside the securities, the public securities market, that are never advised to people. I see this.
So just don't do it.
My answer is don't do it. But if you do it, you better get somebody who knows what the hell they're doing about and telling you the parameters. I get those questions from clients all the time. Can I invest in real estate? And I will joke about, I'll say to them, well, is it commercial or residential? And he says, well, it's residential. I said, when do you think you're moving in? All right. I mean, when you would obviously know that that's something unknown.
Yes, exactly.
And I get that. Exactly. I had someone who I said, buying residential property. I said, where is it located? I said, well, it's in the Pacific Palisades. And I said, that's nice. And I said, is it already built up? No, it's a vacant lot in the Palisades. And I said, well, where are you living? Where do you live? In the Palisades. And I said, is the vacant lot right by you? It was right next to me. And I said, right. That's an act of self-dealing.
But in the 401k space, we can set up what's called a personal choice retirement account, where the participant has a brokerage account within the 401k, and it really becomes a little sandbox where they can do whatever they want with it.
That is a standard way of doing things now, because what happens is especially when you have people with higher valued accounts, they want to have the liberty of getting out of the fund selection and doing whatever they think. Well, that makes puts the tripped employer and the trustee into a very hard position, because the employer still has to monitor those investments to make sure that person doesn't go off the beaten track.
That's actually right where I was going with this, Alex. So thank you. So you think you're doing the right thing.
And I've seen this before.
I'm sure. So you think you're doing the right thing as the employer, giving your employees an option to have flexibility.
But you still have the responsibility to look.
You still have the responsibility to look.
And it's very interesting because I have several clients now that are under the Department of Labor investigation because they have these plans. And the problem with it, which is another Department of Labor area that there's so much to discuss in the program. Too bad we only have a couple of minutes. But the real issue that you have with the Department of Labor with this kind of thing is the administration and the accounting for it. Because all of it has to be folded into an annual report and accounted for. And if you give them the right to go outside that, and if you give them the right to go outside the different brokers, that information doesn't come in very handily, and the reports don't get filed timely with the government, and then the Department of Labor has you over a barrel. I've got very, very big penalty cases as a result of failure to comply with the filing requirements for the Department of Labor in court.
How big is big on penalties?
Well, let's see. A plan that had I got one that's $90,000 and can go to $180,000 because they've just missed another year, and we're in court over that. And I've got another one that was just assessed $50,000.
When you talk about the 6-year statute of limitation,
let's go back for a second. That's the fiduciary ERISA. That's not the Internal Revenue Code statute.
Is that longer or shorter? The IRS
Internal Revenue shorter. Internal Revenue Service statute of limitations is generally 3 years from the time of filing,
Assuming you file, yeah, it's okay. So you were talking about a 6-year statute, really.
Yeah.
But what I want to know, Alex, is not only – I want to talk about really is not only do you have a risk of an employee getting wise to the excessive fees they've been charged, but how public is the documentation relative to the plan? And who out there could be trolling this information to stoke the fire and create these cases? Talk to us about – if you're an employer who's got one of these issues, I think you've got a 6-year span where you're praying that the IRS website doesn't deliver the information on a timely basis to a trolling attorney who might be looking for a claim. Talk to us about that risk.
All right. That puts me in a spot that to show my disdain for the legal profession. So I'm sorry that I have to go down that road.
Aren't you a lawyer, Alex?
Yes, I am a lawyer. But
self-hating lawyer.
Well, all right, but it's not so much that. But what happens is this, is when you look at those people who are looking to file claims, one of the problems that I had, for example, with the fiduciary regulations that came out, that it opened the door for class actions, okay? Now, there's a reason for class actions. An individual action against a company, you know, where it's just a single action but not a class action, is expensive to operate. And if you're under ERISA, you can't take that on contingency no matter how good it is. You have to be paid for it. So the cost of filing a lawsuit is expensive, all right, because the employer, the best that the winning party can do is get repaid their legal fees in court, assuming that the defendant has the money to pay it. Okay. When you're dealing with class actions, ERISA doesn't govern the fees. ERISA, the court will guarantee the fee to the plaintiff, to the attorneys. So the class actions, the attorneys can front all the costs because their settlement will be so big, they're going to get multi-millions of dollars way over and above what a court would otherwise permit in an ERISA case. That's why most of the cases that you see are class action cases. Class action cases are nothing less in many cases than extortion. All right. And so that's what it is. You'll never see a class action case against a small employer. Because remember, when you're filing a suit under ERISA, this is a very interesting point. If you're trying to file for a breach of fiduciary duty, you're filing it on behalf of the plan itself. And the damages are paid to the plan for the losses that are created. That's what the damages are. There are no extra contractual damages. There's no punitive damages. There is the cost of the loss plus interest, you know, maybe, you know, expected gain, so to speak. So if you lost as a result of this in a small company with 100 employees, if the fact that one of the investments doesn't do well and it loses $100,000, your liability is $100,000 on the interest on the expected gain. That's it. Okay. You're not – how many people are going to pay to do that, to get that kind of a retention, especially when you're not going to – because the lawyer's costs are going to be more expensive than the amount you're filing for to do something like mm-hmm. that. So that's the practical – that's why you see them all as class actions.
What are the available damages in a class action?
I'm not sure, but I'm sure it's a percentage of the settlement. That's why they're all settled, because it's too expensive to defend and – they get settled unless somebody's willing to take this all the way to court. The best example of all this is the case you talked about a little before, was the Tibble case against Edison. That went on for years and years and years into the Supreme Court on different occasions for different issues. And then it cuts back to the district court for to review, and then the district court says, well, we can't find any fiduciary breach. So it's very hard to prove a fiduciary breach because what Southern California Edison did, they had Ernst & Young or Ernst & Winnie, wherever it was at that time, doing that due diligence review. They had somebody out there that did the due diligence review, and they were relying on that. So essentially, that's the insulation we talked about before.
From a process standpoint, they had gone through the process of getting somebody who would be doing that diligence. And
that's exactly
doing that
right. And so that protected them. Notwithstanding all the different things that went on for years and years and years, it is very difficult if they go forward into court to prove it.
So when you say it's very difficult to prove a breach of fiduciary duty, is that only in the situation where you have someone like, you know, PwC in that case, or an RIA like us doing filling in that role?
What I'm saying to you is when you're filling that role as a 338, for example, what we've mm-hmm. talked about before, you're insulating the employer from liability. All right. You're taking on a certain responsibility to do it, but you're insulating the employer. That's a perfect insulation. It's a double fiduciary protection. You've got the person who helped you choose the investments, which is one person. Then you have the person who's monitoring it, which because you're not. No employer, when you think about it. Employers have to run their business. The last thing they want to worry about is a 401k plan.
I guess my question is, would it still be hard to prove a breach of fiduciary liability if there wasn't someone in the middle? You know, you're saying it's hard to make the case, but if an employer third parties.
If you don't have that intermediate party doing the monitoring in the 401k plan, you subject yourself to a little bit more exposure. Okay, but look at the practicality. I want you to be the practicableness of this. When I go and lecture on this subject to people, I look at the audience and I say, who are basically people in the industry, and I say, all right, how many of you know ERISA plaintiff attorneys?
Not one.
Not one. Do you know any ERISA plaintiff attorneys?
No.
That makes no sense. You're going to see class action trolls who are doing this.
Because I know several of them who I refer cases to. They don't take anything on contingency. It's costly. You have to pay the money up front because there is no such a thing as a contingency. So unless the damages are significant enough to go out on that limb to pay those expenses, or you're just doing it on faith the principle because that's the way you want to be, you're not going to do it. So let me give you the extreme example. I'm an employee, okay? I have an account balance that's $100,000, okay? It's there, it's sitting there, it's fully vested. I terminate my employment, and my employer can't stand me. Says, all right, I'm going to pay you $75,000. I said, well, I'm due $100. He says, screw you, you're getting your $75,000. I take the $75,000, I file a lawsuit. Am I going to file a lawsuit for $25,000? Where am I going to find a lawyer to do that?
Nowhere.
Okay. That's the practicality of ERISA. That's why you don't see any – I mean, with all the clients that you have you had any clients – you may not want to answer this, but have you had any clients in which anybody has filed a lawsuit for breach of fiduciary duty?
No, but you read about them all the time.
I know you read about them, but you read about these major cases.
So bring this back to our client base, and you know the types of clients we serve. Give us some rules of thumb as to what they should be doing on a regular basis, annual checkups, things to avoid. Give us that. If you're sitting across from a professional who had 100 employees on their plan and 10 minutes of your time, tell us, or 5 minutes of your time, what would you tell them to do over the next few months as a well visit?
Well, I'm going to assume for arguments, for our discussion purposes, that we're just talking about 401k. And as a legal lawyer, I hardly will do work with 401k unless it's a fiduciary issue, because I just think it's nonsense that we have to deal with this, other than the fiduciary issue, which is very, very important, and the mm-hmm. Department of Labor. We still haven't talked about the Department of Labor, and that's the most important part of this piece of what happens when the Department of Labor comes in, and I do want to get into that issue. But the point being here is that with 401k, the checklist is as follows. One, most important thing from 401k, are you depositing the deferrals on a timely basis? And that means within 5 business days after the payroll. Not 2 weeks, not a month, but 5 business days after the payroll. That's the first thing the Department of Labor or anybody goes after. That's their biggest, that's the sense of their biggest violation. The second thing is that as long as the checklist, it's not a daily check. The daily checklist is the depositing. All right, to make sure it's deposited and everybody's getting their account and everybody's getting their reports on a timely basis. And if there's any questions, getting them resolved immediately, but with the advisors. The most important thing is more semi-annual or quarterly, and that's the overview watch of the investment provisions, because that's all there is to it. It's no different than if I come to you and ask you to be my investment provider. Do I not and I give you all this authority, do I not have a responsibility to myself to look at what you've done and to ask questions and to meet with you? All right, I'm, any investment where with assault like you, what you do, which a lot of people don't do, is that they do the investments and they never talk to anybody. You meet with your clients all the time and you go over their investment portfolios. You discuss that with them. You discuss how it's performing and give them all the important information that they need to know. And they have the right to see everything, all right? That's what has to be done. Most people don't do that.
We prefaced that answer by saying this applies to 401ks. Tell us about profit sharing, defined benefit, cash balance. Right. Are there different requirements relative to the three I just mentioned?
Absolutely.
Tell me
and
about
that's that. That's the important thing. There are two generic types of retirement plans. One is the defined benefit plan. The other one is the defined contribution plan. Defined contribution plans include the 401k and the profit sharing. Defined benefit plans are pension plans, quite different. And investment issues are extraordinarily different. The defined contribution plan is what's called an individual account plan. It's like a glass of water. Whatever is in that glass of water, however it's filled up, is yours to the extent that it's vested. So it grows with contributions and gains and losses and so on and so forth every year. All right? And whatever is in that glass is yours. That's a defined contribution plan. If the defined contribution plan is individually directed, which you have with 401k and with profit sharing plans. We go back to the same thing we've been talking about. So it doesn't just necessarily have to be 401k. But sometimes profit sharing plans are invested by the fiduciaries themselves, the employer, whoever they think is doing. Then that person takes on a whole different role of fiduciary responsibility with respect to those investments. So that then they have to, then they really are, because they have no outside person watching over. They think they're smarter than anybody else, and they're doing it on themselves, and they will get themselves into trouble. But in a defined contribution plan, what you see is what you get. It's yours. That's not true in a defined benefit plan. And defined benefit plans are not explained to the clientele very well. They think it's, again, it's a bank account, and I see all these millions of dollars going into it, and it's all mine, and it's not theirs. A defined benefit plan is a liability-driven plan. A profit-sharing 401k plan is not liability-driven from the standpoint the employer puts the money in, doesn't owe any more liability unless it's a fiduciary issue. But with a pension plan, it is a promise by the employer to the employee that as long as you're working and do all the rules under the plan, we're going to have enough money in this pool to buy you an annuity of a pension for life equal to X.
Talk to me, Alex, about a cash balance plan. I understand it's a bit of a hybrid, and there's really a target growth rate that we want to achieve within the plan.
All right. A cash balance plan is something that can be designed in a way. First of all, it is a defined benefit pension plan. It's subject to the same rules as any defined benefit pension plan. It is a promise. You may have set a goal. That's the goal you want to promise to get to. But that's the goal. That goal is X dollars. And those X dollars are no different than what the other would be in a standard defined benefit plan. So, for example, in a defined benefit plan, if you have a person with a very high salary and they get to age 62, my understanding is the lump sum value of that benefit statutorily is going to be about $2.8, $2.9 million. That's the same with a cash balance plan. You can only go to that limit. No matter how much money you think you're putting in, you're going to be subject to that limitation.
And if you overcontribute, what happens?
Well, if you overcontribute, you have an overfunded plan.
And what happens? What's the downside?
The downside? All right. The downside, all right, so let's – I do a lot – that's one of my specialties is dealing with underfunded and overfunded pension plans. All right? So let's assume for argument's sake as an example, you've got somebody who's age 62, has had funded the maximum benefits under the plan, and as a liability is entitled to $2,000,008. And he's the only one in the plan. So let's simplify it. And now there's $4 million in the plan, and it's $1.2 million overfunded. If you act improperly with that and you terminate that, that $1.2 million goes to the United States government.
Wow, not even subject to tax and distribution, but it all goes to the government.
It's a 90% effective excise, income tax and excise tax, right, if you're not careful about it. So I have to deal with – I have lots of clients that I have to deal with now that are massively overfunded and dealing with them and how to correct them and how to deal with it. Now, there are ways of dealing with them, but and I find it unconscionable to ever allow the government to have that kind of a 90% effective tax rate on this stuff. But that's the issue with defined benefit plans. Let me give you an example. If I can.
Yes.
I have a client that had a defined benefit plan. And as
was it a cash balance plan?
No, it might have been a cash balance plan, but it doesn't matter. Again, we're still subject to these limitations. Their funding limitations, their annual funding limitations, and an overall funding limitations. So it's just because you have a cash balance plan, I can't put in $1 million today. They're still actuarially set forth as to what the rules are as if it was a defined benefit plan. So it's still limited by that. All right. So the person is at the end of 2017, December 7th, had $2.5 million in the plan and $2 million of liability. Actually had $2 million in the plan and approximately $2 million plus of liability. Okay. And was putting money in and was still contributing to it. But during 2017, the person had invested in one of these startup companies, and it was public. And during 2018, the stock of this public company exploded. So by the end of 2018, the plan was worth $5 million.
Oh, wow.
The liability was only two and a half. All right. The actuaries that are involved in this case use what's called a beginning of year valuation. So they look at the beginning of the year and they say, well, we have all this liability now at the end of the year. We have to look at the assets at the beginning of the year. You owe a contribution and the plan's massively overfunded. It's asinine. It's stupid. So I have to deal with that issue. But on the other hand, I've got $5 billion in the plan and the liability now is over $3 million. So I've got a massive overfunding that cannot be taken care of. What I had to do because of this stock, and the client was concerned that it was going to go up or it might be taken over, subject to a merger, whatever, or whatever, and it could just explode off the map. And so I congratulated him first for converting ordinary capital gain into ordinary income. But in any event, we have to watch out for those things. But in any event, what we did was the person, our client was 66 years old, and I had the actuary calculate his benefit that he could do because he could, you can have a withdrawal even though you're working after 62. His benefit was $2.8 million. Well, that was almost 80% of the shares that he had, which was he had 240,000 shares of this one investment. So we were able to move immediately 190,000 shares to a profit-sharing plan account because he could take an in-service distribution. We moved it at 15 and that left 60,000 shares in the plan with a couple participants left. It said his benefit was fully out of it. That stock now is 21.
Wow.
So the individual, when he put it into a defined contribution plan, the $1.2 million gain that he just took in the last couple months is in the profit-sharing plan. It's all his. It's the glass of water. The problem is the defined benefit plan now still has $2 million in it, and I got not very much liability. So I have to still deal with the dealing with the overfunding.
That's fascinating.
And that's what happens in the – the opposite is true too. So we go back to 2008, 2009 when the market crashed. You had a defined benefit plan. The assets were here. Now the assets are here, but the liabilities are still here. Now you have underfunding. The employer is liable to make it up, whether they have profits or not. That's what liability is. All right? And you have to deal with it. If you have an employer that has a defined benefit plan with employees and you're in that position, it's an albatross if you're not making enough profits. And I got plenty of those to have to deal with.
I want to make sure that we cover everything with the time that we have. So I know you said you really want to get into what the Department of Labor does when they come in.
Let me get to that. That's an important thing. The difference between the IRS and the Internal Revenue Service can be defined in two different words. The IRS does an audit. The Department of Labor does an investigation. Now, everybody, lay people and everybody else thinks that's interchangeable, an interchangeable concept, but it's not. Because simply, when was the last time you ever saw the FBI, the Justice Department, the SEC do an audit? They do an investigation. So the Department of Labor views themselves no different than the FBI, the Justice Department, and the SEC or any other government institution. Department of IRS is only looking at tax compliance. Everybody else is looking at conduct, whether it's civil and or criminal. Because the Department of Labor has the right to open up criminal cases, and I've had several of those opened up. Okay. There is, you know, with the IRS, there is a very detailed procedure and due process procedure, starting with the agent, with the supervisors, review, going to appeals, and maybe going to court. It takes years to get there. With the Department of Labor, they will, and when was the last time you had an IRS agent demand an interview with the taxpayer?
Doesn't happen.
Doesn't happen. Department of Labor, when they come in, they voluntarily request an interview with the fiduciaries to the plan, the owners and the people in the trust that have power over the plan. They come out as a voluntary thing. Now, most clients and owners in this look at this as a bank account. There's no big deal. So of course I'll go in and talk to them. Would you go to a U.S. attorney's office or the district attorney's office or a police officer without your lawyer in front of you?
No.
They do. So they trap them in there, and what they don't realize that the first words out of the Department of Labor investigator's mouth is effectively a Miranda warning. They basically say, thank you very much. We're here to help. No government agents are there to help. All right? We will be taking a lot of questions and a lot of notes from you. We'll be using these questions and your answers to determine whether there have been any violations of law, and we can share our findings with any other government agency, including the IRS, the Justice Department, the SEC, and so on and so forth. And you're sitting there without a lawyer. And what it's not so much that you think everything is fine, because honestly, you think that way, but you don't realize that when you say something to them, they can interpret it any way they want, and they can interpret it as a violation. You don't know if you said something that's purely honest and simple and straightforward, that it's not a violation because you're just not aware.
Right.
All right. Now, if you don't volunteer,
they'll compel you.
You get a subpoena the next day.
There you go.
And I go through that all the time. If they come out with findings, they will do a report and come out with findings. You either agree to their findings, because there's no appeal, or you're in court. So it's litigation from the get-go with the Department of Labor. Any person who goes and deals with the Department of Labor without counsel is just walking into a trap.
How do these things begin? Is the DOL looking at 5500s?
The Department of Labor, a lot of it is whistleblowing. Employee complaints and so on and so forth. They hear that all the time. The other thing is looking at issues in the filings of the annual report. They will look specifically in the annual report because there is a question for 401k. Are you making the deposits timely? That will open up an audit. When you go off the public securities grid and go into private securities, private investments, and you have to list them on your 5500, they're going to take you on. That is a trigger for them to start to look at, and they'll start looking at all the investments. So they'll just go, and the Department of Labor, the cost of a Department of Labor investigation to the client is 3 to 4 to 5 times more than an IRS examination.
Interesting.
Because they can take their time, they don't have to do anything, and they just will just – they'll go after – they're incessant, okay? They are incessant. Their job is to find a violation.
Maybe we take a moment and questions directed to both you, Alex, and also Donovan, who does a lot of research here at RVW on behalf of clients. How much is it disclosed in the 5500? What can you as a plan sponsor expect to have out there relative to your plan design?
It depends upon the type of plan, number one, and the number of employees. So if you're a single plan, a single employer, single participant plan, now, we talked about that's not covered by ERISA. You file a form called a 5500EZ. EZ means easy. And the amount of information that's requested is very limited. Now, if you have less than 120 employees, you either file a 5500SF or a 5500. An SF is a short form, and that's where your investments are pure cash and securities.
Okay.
All right, but the minute you go outside that, you're required to file a 5500 form, which discloses the value of assets that are outside the public market, real estate, other investments, personal property, and so on and so forth.
So even if that's
an audit trigger.
So even if you have less than 100 employees,
that's right.
As soon as you step outside of those public markets,
that's right.
Now you're crossing over that threshold
that's
and having
exactly
to file
correct.
A much okay. more involved public
When you have 120 or more employees, you now file a full 5500 report, but you're also subject to independent certified audit.
And that's where everything's
okay.
public.
Now, the other thing is this, very, very important. There's an exception to this rule. Generally, anybody under 120 employees does not require an audit. But the rule is so long as 95% of the assets that you were invested in a small business like that plan, are invested in qualifying assets, which are cash, securities, things of that sort. But the minute you go outside and start to go into real estate or loans or things of that sort, you're only exempt from audit if you buy a bond, an ERISA bond, equal to 100% of the value of those outside assets.
And then you're exempt from audit.
And then
you still have to file the full form.
Yes, right. But you're exempt from audit. So a lot of people don't even realize that. And all of a sudden, the Department of Labor comes in and says, where's the audit for this? Because you had disqualifying assets in it. So that's another reason to stay in the securities market, in the cash market.
I want to make sure we cover, because we are kind of short-ish on time. So how would you describe your firm's ERISA legal services?
This is an evolution over years because of the marketplace. Because the marketplace looks at this as a bank account and a brokerage account, I try not to get myself involved in too much defined contribution work unless there is an IRS Department of Labor controversy or there's a lawsuit. I do most of my work now in expert witness and co-counsel in litigation, both in state and federal court. They're fascinating cases. They're all over the field. They go when you're in federal court, it's basically fiduciary cases or employee benefit claims. When you're dealing in the state court, they can be malpractice claims against service providers. They can be death benefit claims where the beneficiaries are fighting over monies in the pension. They can be in divorce court. I'm in there on divorce court when the plan that's being divided is a defined benefit plan, because you can't divide assets in a divorce in a plan. You can only divide the liabilities. So you go back to that liability asset problem. And what happens when you have more assets than liabilities and it's community property and the spouse wants half of the liabilities, half of the assets, and you're not allowed to divide the excess in a divorce under the federal pension laws. So it's very complicated when you have a defined benefit plan. Anytime you have a defined benefit plan, it's complicated. I do a lot of things called what's called withdrawal liability. And that's where your businesses are unionized, which not very many are in Southern California, but they're still union-based. Union plan, when you're unionized and you belong to a union, you're a collectively bargaining agreement and you're contributing to the union pension plan, there's a concept called withdrawal liability. So if you ever sell your company, cease and dissolve your business, go out of business, decertify yourself from the union, you have what's called withdrawal liability. You are responsible for your share of the plan's underfunding. This is 6 figures to 7 figures for small businesses at this point in time, because the union plans are massively, massively underfunded. So if you're ever unionized, you've got this contingent liability holding of yourself. If you sell your assets, you get stuck with it. If you dissolve, you can get stuck with it. There are certain exceptions to the rule. And if you don't follow the rules that are very statutorily defined, the union is in the driver's seat. So that's the other thing. I do a lot of work with investment issues as to what are the problems when you get outside the securities market. Things of that. I do a lot of stuff with overfunded and underfunded plan. And I counsel against the abusive area too. I do a lot of work with insurance and plans, which is a specialty that many people don't have because they don't understand insurance. That's the kind of stuff that I do. I mean, it is purely consulting and problem solving. And controversy, probably. I love the controversy work with the IRS and the Department of Labor, and I love the court work. That's more fun than everything. I'll give you a case that I had. So you see what it is. This is state court. The difficulty between federal court and state court is, in state court, you're trying to tell the judge that they have no authority to make a ruling because federal law is going to preempt them. And they don't like that. Okay. They really don't like that, especially when they're so grounded in California law. Mm-hmm. So dad has a pension plan, a profit sharing plan, has over $1 million and he's still working, designates his wife as a beneficiary and his children as a secondary beneficiary. Wife dies, so the children become the primary beneficiary. Dad is in his early 80s, is taking his RMD every year from the plan. It still has $1 million+ in the plan. But like every male, gets lonely and marries one of his patients. So he's married to the patients and he now has to think about estate planning and everything else. And he hires a lawyer. The lawyer comes in to do estate planning with him and sets up what's called a separate property trust. Because all his property is separate property. It's not community. It's just got married. And the separate property trust says, this is all for my kids. My spouse, new spouse, is not a beneficiary under this trust. It talks about all the assets, including the retirement plan. 15 months into the marriage, lo and behold, dad dies. And the spouse requests survivor benefits under the profit sharing plan.
Okay.
Okay. and the kids go ballistic. See, my theory of death is as follows. You mourn for one day, and then the kids start fighting, where's the money? And now they find out that they're not getting, that there's a claim for this $1.5 million in a profit sharing plan that the wife says isn't, she's entitled to. And they're very, very upset because they know it's separate property and there's no community property here for there to be any division under state law. I got hired by the counsel for the wife, this surviving spouse, as an expert witness. And I just went into court and wrote up the papers and said, listen, federal law preempts. Federal law basically provides a mandated surviving spouse benefit that she's entitled to 100% of this plan because she never consented to this to any other beneficiary, which is required by federal law. They all go ballistic and said, how could that be for a 15-month marriage? And I said, it's under the rule that I coined back in 1984 of I do, I get. You step up to the altar and it says, I do, I really get all that. And that's exactly right. You can put a limitation on marriage as long as it lasts 1 year before you die, before dying, but there was no limitation. So therefore, 15 months, you get it there. I mean, this is a year and 3 months marriage, and she's entitled to $1.5 million. But by federal law,
yeah, it's
preempted.
That pool of money.
They went nuts. We had to settle the case by what the spouse wanted to settle. She got about 3/4 of the whole thing. I wanted to go to trial. I was very much wanted to go to trial over this. I was really impassioned about it. But trying to convince a state court judge that federal law just all of a sudden overrules community property and separate property is just very difficult. And I knew that there was a risk there. They brought the estate planning lawyer into court to try to demonstrate the intent of the father. And my comment was the intent's irrelevant. The new spouse has to consent to that arrangement and never consented to it. And I wrote language in that as to what could have been done had they done it right. Immediately after the settlement, the kids filed a malpractice suit against the lawyer for failing to advise the client on what to do. Mm. And I just got called by the defense counsel for the lawyer to help them with the lawsuit. And I says, you've got to be kidding. It was my language in my brief that basically created the lawsuit against your client. He said, we know, but we need you to help us. And I told him no. But that shows you what can happen at the state court level.
So looking at the website, at your bio on the website and seeing kind of a lot of what you do, it looks like you're very involved with the Small Business Council of America. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you do with them?
The Small Business Council of America is a legislative advocate in Congress for small business owners and small businesses to protect them against any legislation that will be harmful or regulation that will be harmful with respect to the all areas of taxation, income and estate tax, estate planning, retirement, and health care. We're very, very active in Congress. We work directly with the finance committees in both the Senate, the House, small business, and labor committees. We do a lot of testifying. Our job is basically to educate the congressmen, the Congress, our representatives, senators and congresspeople, so that they understand what the issues are. Let me give you a great example. When the last tax bill was passed and they were going to increase the estate tax exemptions to these great high amounts, there was nothing in the bills that said that there would be a step up in basis allowed.
Wow.
All right. So, and many of the people that we spoke to and testified before had no idea what step-up and basis were, because why would they know this stuff? So we had to get that in, because if you didn't put that in, then the idea of exempting somebody from estate tax would trigger them for income taxes on carryover basis rules, which would be impossible to deal with. So we got the step-up and basis back put into it. Another thing we were able to do with this recent legislation, they tried to get rid of the stretch inherited IRA. They wanted that over with. And so they put a limitation on when you could have a stretch IRA and lasted over the beneficiary's lifetime. We got that removed. So we were doing a lot of stuff in that area. We're very active with Congress. And I've had my own work with Congress and legislative activity over the years, which has been a wonderful experience.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alex, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
This podcast is not intended to constitute investment, legal, or tax advice. The ideas and strategies expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those recommended or implemented by RVW Wealth. Please consult and rely exclusively on your professional advisors.